So welcome to this session about computer collecting. Is it a disease? Is it a hobby? Is it taking over nerd humanity? Alan Lundell and myself co-founded the DigiBarn Computer Museum a couple of years ago now. And I just wanted to tell you sort of the story of how this happened, because stories are what people like and what people remember. And just it'll maybe give you an idea of where this can lead if you let it get out of control. So we'll start with our apologies to Jeff. We'll start with a little bit of PowerPoint here. I totally agree with Jeff, by the way. But okay. So DigiBarn Computer Museum. This session is called The Joys and Trials of Vintage Computer Collecting. I almost wanted to call it... like the cookbook's The Joy of Cooking, but I realized that there's a lot of messed up dishes as a result. So there are trials involved too. So basically, the session's really about all the kind of things that happen to you when you set the goal of building a large collection, and in our case, a physical collection and a virtual collection, and then handling what happens, the sort of emergent chaos, the Cambrian explosion that happens around a large collecting, community-based collection rather than simply just a personal collection. So these are the things that were in the program. How do you spot the really quirky stuff but handle the quirky people that come with the quirky stuff? Handle them with, really to care for them. They're the beloved brethren. Not to disrespect them. How to gracefully decline other offers, the 300th offer of Commodore 64s, PC Juniors, things like that. You could say, I'll build a PC Junior totem 60 feet high. That's what I'll do. If you can't say no, that's what you're going to end up doing. How to handle the press. Believe it or not, there is a press around this. There are writers. There's one in this audience, Christine. There are people who are studying us as archaeologists, anthropologists, and whatnot. How to handle them, how to handle open houses without driving your, without having the local constabulary show up or the neighbors disown you, how to keep it this from breaking up your marriage or your relationship or terrifying your pets, things like that. How to do all of this whole thing without any budget, without any real, just in your spare time, and how to document people who visit, because people who, like me, if someone comes and as soon as they arrive, there's a burst. It's like a ketchup burst. They'll see a machine, and then this ketchup burst of memory happens, and you try to record that. And so I got one of these little things, a little memory stick digital recorder that dumps straight to MP3. So minimize it. If you really want to record, do oral history, how to do it, and how to not let... The worst thing that happens in this kind of thing is letting queues of chores pile up. Like there's a huge stack of boxes of people who stuff that's been shipped. You really have to process those queues as fast as they come in, or you end up with your hobby becomes this massive chore that you have to wait till you're 65 and retire, then you get to, how like you process your slides and photos, and you have a huge, that whole thing. And then how to create, because having a collection that's physically located somewhere it's kind of nice, but it's accessible by those people, in our case, who go on Bear Creek Road, get sick, take Altoids, manage to make it, and then come on a tour, and very relatively few people. I think maybe 300-400 people came last year, maybe 200 and some came to the opening. But it really, the virtual, in Gordon Bell's words, it's the online virtual presentation of this material that has a value. The artifacts in themselves are cool to see, but it's the online. Then you get thousands or hundreds of thousands of people able to get this stuff. So really, how to build a good website and how to make it not look like a database-supported website when it really has to have a database under it. But if a database support a website kind of looks rigid and repeated. In this case, I didn't put a website under it, which means everything's done by hand, which is ridiculous. But on the other hand, it's the most flexible. You'll see that later. And then how to one day grow up when you realize that you really are now operating as a as a repository, as a heritage repository, and you have a responsibility. It starts from being this personal obsession and ends up being this is, oh my goodness, this is a responsibility for future historians. How do you then get to the preservation mission that, say, this institution has? But as a private person, how do you start having accession forms and getting all your legal stuff in order? Do you have a nonprofit or not? How do you get a little bit of funding to support the documentary efforts? How do you preserve the systems? How do you keep them from being destroyed by weather and climate? Because they are valuable, or do you donate some of the pieces of an institution like this that can better preserve them? So how did it all start? So that's what we're going to talk about. Maybe we'll never get to any of that, but it started because I bought a farm in the Santa Cruz Mountains in 1998, and there was this barn. I thought, oh my God, it's a 5,000 square foot facility, cement floors, everything. What do I do with a barn? We decided to raise pigs, and the pigs live out here. But we don't have horses, and we're not going to do any of the horse thing. And so what happened was one day, my friend Alan and I decided to go to the Weird Stuff Warehouse, and I had a few pieces of collecting. I had done a lot of work with Xerox in the 1980s putting the Starlight stuff onto PCs, under DOS PCs. I wrote a whole graphical OS myself with Windows and icons and all that stuff. And you can see that upstairs. It's the Elixir desktop. It's next to all the other. We have Altos up there and Stars and 6085s. You can see all that. That's where my passion came from was, oh, my God, you know, how do I get an icon look and feel like a Xerox look and feel onto a DOS PC with 640K? And I did that. Xerox sold that worldwide, still does. And that's where I had the appreciation for the magnificence of what the Xerox PARC team had done and what the Xerox Corporation had done. So for years I'd been searching for Altos and things like that. But it started with this innocent visit to the Weird Stuff Warehouse where I spotted the beloved marshmallow-shaped Televideo terminal, which I had written a lot of code on an IMS S100 machine back in 1981-82. And of course,
have any of you familiar with Weird Stuff Warehouse?
It's definitely weird. So what we did was fill up, I started buying this thing. I think this was like $15 or $10. I had to have it. You know, this is how it starts. You could ask Salam. Salam has a fantastic story about how he started. Salam has thousands of pieces, an enormous warehouse. So then we filled up the car, came back, and found the best room in the barn, so the collection begun. There it is there. There's the exhibit, first exhibit A. Then Alan had a great idea, which was we don't just want to have these machines here sitting on the floor. What we want to do is get them running, because a lot of the life about these computers is when they ran, the sounds of them, what they were showing, what people were doing, and then try to capture that and put that on the web so each little virtual exhibit of a machine, we had some of the life of the machine coming out. And should we try the real thing here?
This was one of our first artifacts that we had a lot of fun with. This was back in 81, I was West Coast editor of Byte Magazine, a publication I'm sure most of you are familiar with. And at the time, Steve Wozniak had just had his plane crash in Scotts Valley. And had recovered from in the hospital, and he had lost some of his memory at the time. I don't know how many of you know this story, but he found out that he was Steve Wozniak and had $100 million to his name. It's a good way to wake up, he asked me. Any event, while he was in the hospital, from my understanding, he saw the Woodstock, the movie, on the tube while in his room. And he liked it so much that he thought, well, with all this money, I should be able to throw a pretty good party. And he decided to do the US Festival, the idea was that the 80s were going to be the US decade. As you know, it became the me decade, but anyway, it was a good attempt. He spent over $10 million throwing this amazing party out in the desert. And in order to do that, he pioneered the idea of using floppy disks to send invitations to people. Right, it was As a lot of marketing people thought that was pretty cool and tried to replicate it after that. But this was the first one that I've ever seen where you actually got a floppy disk in the mail and you put it in, and it was kind of an invitation. And I found the original invitation, and we're going to try to boot it right now on the Apple II to see if it still works after all these years. And that's what you're about to see. This is Waz's invitation to me at Byte for going to the US Festival. First one in 82.
And he custom made these. He like made all these floppies and personalized them all, and he did the graphics, and then he mailed them all out to all the journalists and friends.
Let's see if the Apple shows up on the screen. That's
I do.
Yeah, I'm going to wait till I have something to select.
Yeah.
It's probably RGB2. And it should be video there. Yeah. Okay. There we go. We've got the...
Clap. Everybody clap.
Okay, now if I remember correctly, it takes about a minute to boot. Let's see if this floppy is still good.
So
it's making the right sounds. I recognize that.
The red light is on.
Yeah.
We're going to show you some other artifacts later that have tremendous stories behind them. One of them is Daniel Kottke's music computer. But here we go.
Yeah, that is. That's how it began. This is his text on inviting all of us in the geek community to the US Festival. It's just kind of fun. What was really unique about this music festival, what was an attempt to merge the personal computer world with the music world. And it was a very interesting marriage. We had several circus tents that we had to fill with technology for people to peruse while they were at the rock festival. Very different states of consciousness, I might add. And not so much these days, but in those days, they were like two worlds. And, there was a symmetry.
Another little song.
There you go. Now is the first floppy invitation in our artifact archive of the DigiBarn Computer Museum.
So I think what we're going to do now is run a little video back on the projector of try to give you a physical tour and a virtual tour off the museum. This tour actually was prepared for John Toole and the board of directors of this museum, just to sort of show what we're doing. Okay. There's the pigs.
Welcome to the DigiBarn. 2 years ago, roughly, Alan and I went to the Computer History Museum, or then the Computer History Center at Ames Research Center at Moffitt, and we met John Toole, and we were really excited about his collection and his collection of the Computer Museum History Center. And I remember commenting to John that, hey, why don't we, is it possible we could do something to bring some of the machines to life or to focus on the software and the interactive experience? And John said, gee, that's a good idea. Well, why don't you do something about that? You know, stay in touch with us. Why don't you go look at it?
And then, of course, you get more contemporary. I mean, you see that's what the DigiBarn is all about. I mean, you can see how Apple, kind of the evolution of Apple, is a Xerox star, or look at Xerox Park, some of the things that work contemporary.
John, here it is, the DigiBarn Computer Museum. Starting from small beginnings here in our barn in the Santa Cruz Mountains, we started collecting computers. and getting donations and buying them on eBay and getting a lot of visitors and filled up the upstairs three rooms. And then we decided, well, let's have an opening and let's invite the Computer History Museum people and a lot of other people from the industry. So we built it up, expanded and filled the entire barn. So let's get started. First off, let's get you signed up to our registry, get you a name tag, and your donation to Piglet, Tino, or Mama, the three pigs that live here in the barn, get you signed in, and then we'll move on to Buddha, because this is my favorite room, because this is the room in which you get to do the whole timeline. Through this period from 1975, from home brewing, personal computer. And here we have our Amidst Altair 800D system, a lot of great stuff, great original Altair notes, an MSI 8080 from an Exploratorium, Peter Jennings' original MOS technology, King-1, that was used to program microchips. Gee, it goes on all the way up here. Beautiful, beautiful Sol 20. Leif Felsenstein and company built the Commodore FET 2001 series. We have a wonderful TRS-80 Model 1 with a green floppy drive, which really was just a tape drive. And then on through the Apple Revolution, this very interesting piece here, the Microsoft Museum is now looking into, which may be one of the first Microsoft Basics sent from Microsoft in Albuquerque to Apple. Sort of a really historic thing. On through Apple, here we have our Lisa in the process of trying to boot up and showing the birth of the graphical interface. On through the CPM world to this interesting comparison here, the Grid Compass, the same year as the Osborne 1, incredibly different technology. And here we have the Osborne Learning Word Star on a 5-inch screen. Over to our right, we have the great event of 1984, the shipping Macintosh, the very, very first shipping Macs, first Byte magazines. And the rest of the room here, we've got the beginnings of the end for a lot of these systems, the IBM Personal Computer 5150, which really ended the CPM era, and then on to the 80s until the next cube at the end of the 80s. The other part of the major lineages we have, to our right, we have Xerox world, a completely different world that existed from the mid-70s from Park on, a world of network documents and visual interfaces and network systems.
Many of those machines are upstairs now.
Prior to the web and prior to the rest of us having this, and we created a complete Xerox network here to run the applications of this Maze War and bring a lot of things back to life. Here we have the original Xerox Star system from 81, and the really, really early artifacts. We have the Xerox Doll film here, first of the D machines. And we have a Max C here, a piece of the Max mainframe and a prototype of the last beam machine from Xerox PARC. Here's a special table that we put out that relates three different artifacts. The first is the Altair 8800, the first widely used kit computer, which is programmed by switches on the front panel. We have Rich Today's Finite State Fantasies, which is a cartoon book that was produced in the summer of 75, and it's all about the nascent computer culture of kit makers, and it's about people building alternate realities and real vision for what was going to happen in personal computing. We have Ted Nelson's Computer Lab, signed for us by Ted. Published even before the birth of the personal computer. Here's a big mainframes. And it's also kind of a cartoonic, sort of cartoonic polemic about the culture that would arise in the era that we're looking at, 1975 up. And Ted's actually given us permission to scan this and put this on the site as research. And lastly, we have a dedicated research, Palo Alto Research Center, was given to me by John Seeley Brown, and it contains all the original papers from the decade of Park, which really was somewhat disconnected from this, but it was a parallel track that led to innovation. We're now going up to the Cambrian explosion of personal computing, and as we go, we see that the walls are coated with t-shirts that we've chosen from our 3,000 t-shirt collection. They give a really nice effect and surround you with the element symbol of the geek culture of the t-shirt. So here we are playing around at home, which is a gallery devoted to the home computer. And here are two network vectors. These are actual vector-based game systems from the very early 80s. And I don't see very many vector-based systems.
Yeah, those at the US Festival.
Really fascinating, very cheap game consoles. And over here we have the great peanut butter keyboard and Atari 400, the tank, the venerable tank of home arcades. It's been destructible, probably only run in 100 years, playing popular games like Space Invaders. And over here we have the updated Pong in color from 1976, the two-player Pong, which I'm terrible at. Oh, I lost. And several other systems. And jumping forward into the late 1990s, the Odyssey, because computer history is not just about 20 years ago, it's about today. The Odyssey is a project at 3Com to make a kind of a kitchen computer that anyone would use, surfing the web, just a beautiful interface on a keyboard. People wonder what happened to the Odyssey, and well, it's here in the museum, but for consideration of what happens to innovation in the business process. Here it is, the Odyssey. And now we have the 80s beige invasion. Boring beige business boxes of all kinds as the personal computer started to become a commodity. The Sanyo PC, of course, it was Sanyo would make a PC that looked like a VCR. And here we have operating system wars, applications and operating systems. So we have on this side, we have the Windows world, the Microsoft world, and we have on this side everybody else. So kind of shows you the back and forth of what was going on. And of course, people don't realize that many of the applications, say for the Macintosh, were written by Microsoft. And here are some of the comparisons that Apple would do, flooding the tide of the growing dominance of the PC. So here in this one exhibit is sort of embodied the process and the excitement of the time in the 80s when this great competition was occurring. And down here, we have something pretty special. We have original Microsoft mouse. And we have a running version of Windows 1.0 coming on up, 1985-86. There it is. Windows. And here's back in the mid-80s, a system that I wrote about the time that Windows 1.0 was coming out. I was coding a desktop operating system for a small company named Elixir in New York by Xerox. So there it is running on a 10-year-old, 15-year-old PC, and there's my desktop that I wrote based on the star metaphor. So this is what actually got me excited about all this stuff, interfaces and their evolution and the machines that ran them. Portable systems like the XO terminal, all the various variants of portability and computers on the move. One of my favorites is this here, the Cortex-X10 from 1969 a portable personal calculator. At last, a portable computer for executives, the foam context. And here we have the man on the train with his foam personal, don't call a portable computer. You could try it for 2 weeks free. But mathematical giants for 2 weeks free. Magic. Magic hat. And here we have Steve Jobs next. In fact, one of the last models of the next. The color next slab. Just a beautiful system, beautifully designed. And, you know, just common sense. Beautiful gold connectors, and when you want to turn it off, you just hit power off, and it says power off, and you say, turn it off. No mess, no fuss. So here we are, back in another world, in PFS Write on an Apple IIe. Really, really limited, simple word processor, but hey, when all you had was an impact printer, now we'll go down to the Macintosh Wave.
Entire Macintosh was called a 512K motherboard.
And this is the only existing reproduction of this D diagram of the Mac from Daniel. Speaking of Jobs and Wozniak, this little exhibit here shows the culture of Apple, the two different cultures. The culture of Steve Jobs, which was built a beautifully designed machine that was very closed. In fact, the only way to open up an original Macintosh was this device, the Mac Cracker, to allow you to crack open the case. And if you did that as an end customer, you voided your warranty. And Steve was so sure that he wanted a perfect quiet system that he ordered this original first Mac not to have a fan, because he wanted something that wasn't clunky like old computers. So people burned them up because they tended to need a fan. So one company invented the Mac chimney. It was something you put on here and they would create a chimney effect and draw the heat off. Over here we have Wozniak's last design for Apple, the Apple 2GS, and this is actually a Woz limited edition 2GS, and it's just a beautiful, simple design. It's very open, it's very extensible. Roughly at the same time that the Mac was getting going, this was getting going, this culture lost out ultimately at Apple, and you ended up with a culture much more in the image of Steve Jobs. Here we have some Apple, one of these. Here's an original D-Box running the D operating system, which didn't have a long life. It's just been liquidated as a company. It's an interesting history. And here we have the Dynamac, the company in Colorado built the first portable Macintosh. And in fact, this is a Dynamac used by Apple to move around and do network and system operations. And it prompted Apple to finally build a portable Macintosh. But here we have Galen's Tchotchke wall. This is Galen's art direction here, and all the different Tchotchkes and books and things that have gone along with the PC and network culture, digital culture in the last 25 years. And one thing that's very rare and very odd is the Smack-a-Mac, something that was made for Macintosh. I don't know why, but you just so you could give it a smack. And there it is, the Smack-a-Mac. There's a whole story behind this. So thank you for joining us here for the quick tour of the DigiBarn Computer Museum up high above Silicon Valley in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And we're going to close up the barn now, and hope you'll come back and join us sometime soon.
I promise you that's sort of a remote physical tour of the DigiBarn, which has even grown more and more, and there's been more and more contributions. But next I want to talk about trying to create a virtual museum to really share the collection. And that is a really major challenge. There's many approaches to doing this. A typical site will have just a long listing of systems. This is what I have. And I sort of looked at some of those sites, and I thought, well, that's kind of this. There's got to be more to the story than that. So I tried to, in sort of an emergent way, as this thing, even how do you classify things? So this is an issue here at the Computer History Museum. What is the taxonomic way to classify these artifacts? And so I kind of took a very, very informal approach of stuff came in. I said, okay, what do I call this class of artifacts, and how do I cross-relate it to other artifacts? And I decided very early on I was going to write a MySQL site. And there's some wonderful database-backed sites that show artifacts and whatnot, but every page looks the same. You have the statistics on the machine, a picture, et cetera, et cetera. So as you're going through it, you kind of get into this repeated mode, and you're kind of locked into what the database, what your design, produced. And I thought, I really can't afford to lock myself in, because how you tell the story of personal computing is really a wandering story of links. It's a real Ted Nelson experience. So, for example, when someone comes and has their ketchup burst and sees a system, they start belting out all these facts and people, and they start bringing documents and artifacts, and I realize this is this tangled rat's nest of interconnections. So I decided to build the entire site completely by hand so that I could put links anywhere and make any page look funky in any way, because in fact, especially personal computing, it's a funky, with a funky industry.
Do I hold that thing again?
Oh, it'll pick it up. Thanks, John. So anyway, the site, then I thought, oh my goodness, how do people navigate through all this stuff? And I went back to the idea that if you have a database, you're kind of, then you have a little entry field that says, put in the name of the system that you want to find out about. And the problem with all that is it's very hard to scan. It's very hard to sit down with a cup of coffee or 10 cups of coffee and say, I'm just going to explore, because then you have to know what you want. Well, often you don't. You just want to, people who come to the DigiBarn, it's a trigger. It's like we call it a memory palace. You know, the idea of the memory palace in the Middle Ages in the Renaissance was a place you came and you saw an artifact or something and brought a memory back. So this is a nerd memory palace. So when people are walking through it, they're doing this kind of random walk through it, and they're seeing things in a random order, and they're starting to pull the memories out of them. So what I decided to do in the collection was simply, and you may think this is terrible, but list the entire thing, and this is actually about a third of what we have, but it's the most interesting stuff, on a single page. So what you can do, this is like a broadsheet newspaper, you can simply go down it, say, oh, that's cool, I'll jump off and explore that. Oh, there's some video. Oh, there's a song. IBM, the IBM song is in there. Oh, look. Oh, what is that? Oh, my gosh. It's a cassette. But, oh, wow. You know, this is an example of someone randomly perusing this single linear list, and they see this, they get to here, and they, you know, we sent this to Paul Allen's archivist, and they're saying, this could be one of the first releases of software between Microsoft and Apple. So it's an artifact. It's kind of interesting. Albuquerque, New Mexico was probably produced in 1977. And it's sent to Bandley Drive, stamped AppleSoft Basic. So it's like, oh, that's pretty strange. So then there's a bunch of people looking at that. So then I what I did was I thought, in the brain now has to say crosslink, crosslink, crosslink. What's this related to on the rest of the site? Mention of Bill Gates and Paul on at NITS. Because in this first issue of Byte, actually the second issue, they go on a road trip to find out, Carl Helmers goes on this road trip to find out if any of these people are real. And so the first place he goes is to Sphere Computer in Bountiful, Utah. And the founder of Sphere, actually, spoke here at the VCF several years ago. That's the gentleman up there. And then they end up at the MITS factory. But then, by going through this Byte, I found this little weird thing here, which was, it's right here, it's talking, they also have a very busy group of college types working away at program development. They're delivering BASIC now and are about ready to let loose extend BASIC, and that's Paul Allen and Bill Gates. So then it's, you know, that's a link that you pass through. Oh, no, there's another thing on the first issue of Byte magazine, and gee whiz, you know, oh, there's a homebrew. It's a homebrew newsletter, and actually this mentions Captain Crunch, who set up an account at Call Computer in Palo Alto, so people could dial in with their Altairs and put store characters at 23 cents per K per month. And then I said, wait a minute, that's the first online community. And anyway, so you can sort of see how the linking, so the whole site is developed to allow this exploration to happen. So then after another cup of coffee, they find themselves going back up to this, and then they keep on scrolling, and then they see, oh my goodness, they see Maze War. Now what's that related to? Oh, Maze War. And then, now what happened here, one of the things I wanted to take advantage of was the collective curation or the collective history reporting of thousands of people. So what happened was, this is a very good example. Maze War is arguably the first multi-user graphical 3D game. It was coded on the INLAX in the 1971-72 and ported to many, many platforms. And it was an eyeball. You were an eyeball character in a maze going around shooting at other eyeballs. And it was on the Alto, it was on at Project NAC at MIT. It was an amazing thing. It was the tap root of all multiplayer gaming. And I didn't even know about it until somebody brought me this printout from a Xerox Star. I scanned it, and I said, what is this? And then suddenly, within about 3 weeks, I started getting all this input, like a blog almost. So suddenly all these people who were somehow Googling Maze War, I don't know why, out of the ether, it's a great game, but there was almost nothing about Maze War on the net. But suddenly I had about a dozen people who put the story together about Maze War. And now we have a project with these people to resurrect Maze War on a number of systems, including the Alto. It runs on a Palm OS. And to do a big stage show at SIGGRAPH 2004, because it's the 30th anniversary of Maze War. And to do it with Lauren Carpenter's paddles, where people in the audience can operate, 5,000 people can play Maze War in the audience at once. We did that with Pong in 1994. So this innocent little scan has led to an enormous amount of self-generated input. And one of the problems, of course, I have now is I have over 1,800 pages. So each of those pages could draw a Google hit, which could draw, unfortunately, an input from somebody or a question. So I've got this enormous, once a month I have this huge stack of inputs to go through and either add their comments to the site or reply or get them to write more. And then each of those 1,800 pages starts to grow. And then maybe in 10 or 20 years, this will be an enormous resource for museums and for people writing histories. And some of the amazing contributions I get is this guy in Holland has over 3,000 screenshots of all user interfaces. So he had nowhere to put them. So he said, I'll send you a DVD of the gigabyte of snaps, of all versions of OS 2 Warp, all releases of Windows, all releases of the Mac OS. Amiga Video Toaster. He spent years getting these screenshots from about 1982. And so I said, I'll put them up. And they're kind of just screenshots. But you want, to see Red Hat version 5 or 4 or 3 or, there's Windows 286. That's actually running. Windows 1.0 screenshots. They're all here. So that's an online contribution. That's sort of a contribution. Then another crazy thing started happening. this goes on and on, folks. There was a student in Canada who was doing a computer sort of history research project, and he had this original, I don't know if you guys remember this, bushy tree diagram. This was published in 1984-85 in IEEE. It's sort of, there's a long history of trees and graphs showing relationships. One of the earliest ones is, sorry, I'm scrolling around. This is the Army large ENIAC on up to the 60s. That's one of the first trees. Gordon Bell's fanatical about these trees. So what we decided to do as a team, him doing a lot of the research, is to attempt to update this to the year 2000. So we probably made tons of mistakes, but this is the update of this to the year 2000. And each of these things is a live link. So everything goes to either a resource on the net or some resource on the DigiBarn site. So you can use this as your way to follow through, starting with MX. And I was able, luckily, to put my own system in there, which hadn't been in that. But I hope it's not too much of a rewriting, inserting of histories. But now we get tons of comments on this. Why are you missing something? Or these are all visual systems, pretty much. And then you should still show the darker, stronger link between Word and Bravo X. And there's somebody down here that said, why? The thick line running from Bravo X to MS Word. So that emerged. We'll go back here. And then categorizing parts. People care about the Microsoft RAM card. There's a huge number. Something that's happened to us is this overflow of people will say, here's five boxes of S100 cards. Like, all right, now in the beginning, I actually paid money for these things. I bought them on eBay for like, oh, I have to have that. That's a Z80 card. I'll pay $35 on eBay. Now I've got crates of them. Until one day, a guy emailed us. He lives in Watsonville, and he said, I have this very large S100 system that I'm just about to turf until I found your page on Dwight Elvey and the S100 restoration we were doing. And would you like to come and see it? So I drive down there, and in his horse barn is a 9-foot-tall S100 power. And I say, with big power supplies, all beautiful, beautifully made system. I said, what is this? He said, it's the S100 multiprocessor. It's a supercomputer made out of S100 cards. And I was about to send it to the Watsonville dump. And I said, I have boxes of these cards. I can, he'd thrown most of the cards away. But so now we're going to get that and just use it as a storage bin. We're going to put it next to the Cray supercomputer to compare. This is $15 million in 1980 dollars, Tony's Cray supercomputer. And then here's the hobbyist version, which costs about $200,000 to make. And it's for specialized math functions. You can have hundreds of processor boards in the thing, and it works. Well, it doesn't work now, but it worked at the time. But the oddest things, and one of the things that was just came in was this. This is a Dave Boggs Ethernet drop at Park that they ripped out of the ceiling and Ken Pierre gave to me a couple months ago. And that was probably going to just get given away or turf, but if you think about it, in 50 years, this is the Ethernet drop to the co-inventor of Ethernet, right? This is Boggs right there. You know, so I think what this tells us is right now it's so much junk, but in 50 years, people are actually going to sort of discover that this was a really important period of invention, and that the things that they're living with, they're going to care a lot more, and that we as collectors, it is our mission to preserve this, not certainly the stories and weird oddball artifacts, so that when people do find that they care more about it, then they'll be there. We'll have tons of audio, and we'll have video of people talking. They'll try to interrelate the people, and the artifacts will exist. You know, thanks to Gwen and Gordon Bell, you know, we have incredible artifacts here from that would have been thrown away. There's Jeff Raskin's original first ever joystick made for an Apple computer, with Windows 95 launch party tchotchkes. Next flag.
I have this artifact I can demonstrate.
Now here's another very odd artifact that Alan will demonstrate.
Yeah, this is an interesting artifact in that it was one of the first attempts to connect the microcomputer with the human body. It's a device called a GSR2 by Thought Technology from Montreal. And I'm going to try to show you the interface. This came out, this was spawned the biofeedback industry. It's now quite much used in the mainstream medical world.
You have to push start on
this. This is the device. It looks like a mouse, but it connects directly to your nervous system through these electrodes. What's nice is that it will cover, this is the company, Thought Technology. And you basically put your fingers in here like this, and you relax in front of the machine.
This is calms you down.
This is one of the, right. And I think the most interesting item for this was the attempt to combine computer games with stress reduction, physiological stress reduction. Okay, let's do it fairly easy here. Okay, here we go. And this was the game. So you had to, the more tense you were, the harder it was to navigate. Yeah, so as you're relaxed, it got easier. Yeah, it's a tension-producing game. But the idea was that levels of difficulty, and you learn to master your nervous system by mastering this game. It's an intriguing idea, and it turned out to be quite successful, and that the company that did this now has 40 employees that are designing all kinds of really cool medical devices and biofeedback for exciting concepts like urinary retention and, you know, all the other good things that medicine has thought up. However, you know, this is its humble beginning in the early days of computers and medicine. So that's that out of fact.
So thank you, Prof. Rowell, again.
One thing I'd like to say is that, you know, Bruce has been excellent at collecting the artifacts, and it's been more my job to collect the stories behind the artifacts. And both of them have been dovetailing very nicely. It's been quite exciting to hear people's stories, and especially when we have gatherings, we bring people together. Some of the brainstorms are quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of minute video clip of someone that's fairly young that started having memories about computers for the first time by seeing a machine that he had when he was 6 years old. Now, I didn't grow up with computers when I was six, so it was kind of interesting for me to document someone actually growing up from a very early age in that. I'd like to show you that. It's about 2 minutes, and it gives you an idea of the kind of excitement these machines are generating in people and the kind of memories that it triggers off when they see people having fun with them. And they see their old machines that they were brought up with. Let's see.
And Alan and I produced about 2 dozen shorts that you can go and see on the site on all kinds of topics. Yeah, this is a great piece here.
Yeah, let's see. We've documented many, many people. Let's see if I can get the volume up here for you guys to hear. We just got the speakers and the proximal. Okay.
I was 6 years old, and I got a 400 with a peanut butter keyboard.
Oh my god.
That's what you used to call it.
Oh, 400.
Trying to type on that thing.
Classic.
You couldn't speed type on these things at all.
Oh no.
And all I ever did, I spent more time in BASIC than anything.
Yeah. How long did you spend on those machines, sir?
Oh my god, 7-8 hours a day as a 6 year old. 6 years old, but all I ever did was.
How many lines of code did you write?
do a nonprofit around that, just so we can capture those memories. We did the Alva panel here yesterday in order to try to capture the vital. I learned stuff that I never thought I would learn about what made the Alva special, and just capture that, stick that online so anyone can immediately get online and people can listen to that and then comment on that and then continue to add to that legacy. So what we hope to do is over 10 or 15 years, if I'm able to keep going on this thing, is to provide a vast raw archive that's not curated, it's not really fact-checked, it's just raw, so that folks at an institution like this can draw from that and then start to build a larger picture. Historians can write books and things like that. Beyond that, I mean, on the site you'll notice we sort of start adding categories and categories. After a while, you know, the help section of what are we missing in terms of machines, the key machines that we're missing, and you just list what you still need, and people come up with it. It's incredible. They come up, and you know, often you have to pay shipping. You know, we didn't need the nonprofit status for the collection because people just want a home for these things. Generally, I'll only accept a machine that was working when it was turned off, and it comes with a person who will help tell the story of it. It's not just a random thing off of a loading dock.
So they are working. It's, in that sense, it's more than a museum. It's more like a nursery. That they're alive.
Alan has a theory that, like Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, he and I and our friends are going to be saved when the machines come with
Yeah, if they ever get intelligent. We got your prophecy. Your history is right here.
If you're in the barn when the TX arrives, they're going to look around, they're going to be scanning, but then they're going to see their ancestors. Like, you're going to duck behind the Tacoma Cat 2001, and they'll get emotional, right? They won't be able to off you because you're caring for the nursery of their ancestors. They won't be safe. So Arnold's working on that.
Now we've got the Terminator for governor.
So I think, in a sense, this is one of the most fun things I've ever done. I've met more people through this than all the businesses I've ever started or anything I've ever done. And you're fantastic. The people are fantastic. Some of them are really seasoned people, starting companies, everything. Some of them are people's kids are really excited about this. And it's just been probably the best hobby I've ever done. And it does take over your life. So, you know, if you can have your spouse involved and believing in it, it's a good thing. Salam can tell you about all that. I mean, Salam's the great kahuna of all this. We sort of look at Salam as our guide in terms of how to do stuff. And then what's very important in the collecting community is share and share alike. We use the Creative Commons license for everything. What, in intellectual property terms, you'll get a photograph or you'll get a document, you want to scan it and put it on the site. Well, we work with Larry Lessig at Stanford University, who's developing with an institution there a license that isn't a copyright. It allows permission to use something. Copyright, like, has become 70 years or 90 years. It's ridiculous. And it's locking things out of the public domain. But all of this stuff, companies don't care about it. It's not of any commercial value. So what we do is they do and ask permissions later. We apply the Creative Commons license, which allows non-commercial use of any picture. If someone takes a picture and makes a derivative of it, they mix it up, they have to issue the mixed-up picture with the same Creative Commons license. If you're putting stuff online, and then we have an escape clause that we built, we designed, we've had it checked with lawyers that says that, you know, if anything on the site that belongs to you, contact us and we'll follow your instructions. So take it down or put your copyright notice on it, etc. But it's really important to do something like that. If you don't have some kind of a notice on your site, it's a lot more messy. So I would encourage you to look the digibarn.com site, look at how we've done our license, and, you know, consider adopting it. I think it's a very, very strong, it's on every page, since we're not online here, but it's a very strong license. And generally people don't care. They don't care if you're reproducing the materials. An institution like PARC does, and PARC will give you permission to reproduce it, but they do. Some institutions really care. Defunct companies, you know, who's ever really going to care? So, anyway, that's another part of doing a virtual collection. We're starting to do weird things like producing 3D models in Dolby Atmosphere of a machine that open it up and put flash on it so that you can actually look at an interface running, sort of 3D walkthrough, flash reproductions, all the video, all the audio, as best we can use the tools as best are available. And doing the openings and having people come in and videotape and audio tape them and just continue. Don't let the queue get too big. Don't get too many unopened boxes pile up. Don't have too much audio to process. Just process those queues. If the queues get too big, you'll never get to it. It'll be like big constipation of the mind, right? I'll do it when I'm 65, and then your collection will, your whole thing will freeze up, seize up. So you can't retake in more than you can process, but use any technologies you can to shorten the time, like, you know, instant audio to MP3 and you're done, send it onto your site. And the DigiBarn project is a collective. It's, we host a lot of content from other people who couldn't find homes or put it on sites that have banner ads and pop-ups. We'll put it on our site to keep it going. And so there's maybe 50 or 60 people, different people's content, different museums are in here as well. It's about 1.5 gigabytes of compressed, actually, to compress it this morning, of information right now. So it's probably about 3 gigs now of information. And, you know, eventually you get on TV. I was on CBS Morning News in May for an anniversary of the Xerox Star. Dave Canfield Smith was on the same program. It's really fun, you know, go to New York and go in a studio and get recorded. It's a really fun thing to do. Salam, of course, is always on the news too. So I guess we should open it up. We're the last speaker, so I guess we're not going to kick out right away. So maybe we should open it up to questions for Al and myself. I want to acknowledge Galen Brandt, my partner over here, who has been an incredible supporter of this project. And hasn't disowned me. And thank you very much. And you know, Alan for making all tremendous media and being a partner in the museum project. And with that, we can open it up to some questions, comments. Jeff? So the Canon Cat probably didn't have a fan either. But the Canon Cat didn't record me. Yeah. Questions or comments back here? It's actually more primitive than that. I ought to do a wiki. What I've got is a submit form and little check boxes. Do they want it on the site? What you have to be careful. Over the last 2 years I've developed this. They have to opt. They tell you, do you want it on the site? Do you want it in the blog, which is just, I do my by hand. Do you want your name associated with it? Do you want your email address associated with it? You know, you have to let people opt in to the different representations of what they're contributing. And then I just take this huge stack of things every week or every month, and I just put it, because I have to use my brain as the database. I have to say, okay, where does this fit? This fits under the description of the system, but it also fits over here, and then it fits in the general blog. So I may distribute their comments several places. Yeah, it might be. I actually need help in trying to figure out how to layer something like that over top of all this stuff.
That question about needing help makes me think of the next thing. Have you considered having co-maintainers? I mean, it seems to me like your workload is becoming akin to Linus Torvalds' workload when maintaining the kernel, where he's got these thousands of patches going in, and he doesn't have time to review them all, so he's got co-maintainers in charge of various parts system, and you seem to seemingly have a similar kind of love.
Yeah, I do have an issue with the people who have their own content on the site. One of the problems is that they cannot, they have access to those subsections and they maintain them, but the cross-linking of, they put something up that's relevant to another thing, or how do you put a link in there? Interestingly enough, one of the people who we've done some work with is James Burke, the guy who did the Connections series, and we're doing there's a number of people at UC Santa Cruz doing a project called the Nate K-Web, and it's trying to develop a technology that can allow this linking stuff to be done through people and their relationships. And after that is done, I've told James what we want to do is apply all this stuff to living, recently living people in who helped make the digital era come to life, so that we can build all that platform underneath the entire effort. And James is pretty excited about that because he's focused on hundreds of years ago. The current project's focused on the time of Mary Shelley and things like that. And he's got 3,000 biographies that he researched to try to create connections to find out who was, were they both in Venice at the same time and therefore they met. And so that's something that's percolating. Question here?
This is a very mundane question. Can you go over the schedule for the tour today?
Yes, what we're going to do on the tour is as soon as we manage to get, and you could already be, if you have a vehicle, you could be very helpful. We actually have to take all the Xerox machines, put them in various vehicles, and then we're going to drive over to the DigiBarn, which is about 45 minutes drive from here, and probably leaving as soon as we get the stuff packed up, so it could be like 3:30 or 4 o'clock, and I'll draw quick maps, but it's not that hard to find. It's windy, got your Altoids, but that will allow you to come in. We've recently cleaned up. We've told the pigs to be on their best behavior. And then you can come on a personal tour today. And then maybe we can go to Boulder Creek, which is a cute little town, and go to the brewery or something for dinner later. But you're all very welcome to join us. And what I would suggest is just rendezvous, if you want to come, rendezvous upstairs at our area, which is where all the Xerox machines are and the DigiBarn banners, in, I don't know, an hour or something like that. And bring your vehicle, if you have a vehicle, it will be a plus. Question here? Yeah, we have an X and Epson QX10. I'm looking for Valdox for it.
We don't have a Valdox.
Larry Niven, interestingly enough, a science fiction writer, he and Jerry Purnell pounded out Lucifer's Hammers and several other of their books on Valdox and the QX10. Yeah, so I told them I would try to get a system running for the next time they were up.
This is a sheet computer. It's an experiment by Puma in the mid-80s. And what's interesting about this is that the battery still works.
This is what Alan used to attract women jogging on the beach.
Yeah, it's seen a lot of use.
So again, if you do have an odd, you're a collector, so you're probably not having stuff in your garage to give out. But if you have something very odd, or something that really has an interesting story behind it. We do also have, to some extent, a loan program where we'll take stuff, people who, it doesn't make sense for it to be in a garage, and we'll exhibit it. This is Daniel Kottke's music computer is an example of something he's loaned us so that we can at least show it and tell its story, but it stays in his ownership. We do that to some extent as well. But we can actually issue no guarantee that, the problem is of security. It's a barn. How do you secure a collection like this? Well, for most people, hauling off this stuff doesn't really mean a whole lot. The pigs are great watch pigs. But the stuff really isn't that valuable. I mean, if you look on eBay and things like Altair is selling for thousands of dollars and whatnot, I suppose that has some value, but most of the stuff isn't that interest to the general public. Question in the back.
What
Yeah, the challenge of exhibiting this stuff is a really major issue. What we've done is generally, I mean, you saw the whole layout. You've either got a table at eye level or low level that people can sit down at. Machine. What tends to be interesting is the artifacts that surround the machine, if the machine is running, that someone can sit down, load some code, and operate it. That's of interest. What we tend to have found is that visitors, as they come, they'll bring stuff and they'll put the artifact next to the machine where it should go. So it's sort of self-exhibit. And then, you know, like somebody came and put David Ahl's picture above a certain machine. And then I recorded why that mattered. So that stays there, and we took a picture of that. And so the whole thing has been populated. Oh, this T-shirt goes with that. And the story is so... I then record the story, and as the, especially the lineage room that you saw, the first room you saw me walking around, it's become a richer and richer story, because now I know that the 50... Why is the IBM 5120 sitting next to the IBM 5150, and what's the great story between IBM's last personal computer that they built in 1978 and the 5150, which they outsourced. And so the walk through this room, if you want the full story, is now really slow, because there's so much to tell between the linkages between the machines and the artifacts associated. It can take an hour to get that through that room, because the density of the contribution of story plus artifacts that are now plastered all over the place. So I don't know, maybe that is the canonically best way. It's traces, it's walk-through storytelling traces through these systems that somehow link them. It's a very oral, very verbal thing. It's very strange, because the artifact only carries so much information, but the stories interwoven are really what is, I think, interesting.
If anyone needed a genuine multimedia relational database, it's us to tell the story of the information age. And we have the advantage of it being relatively recent, so a lot of the pioneers are still alive, and we can get the stories, unlike many other areas of human endeavor where people have died, and we still have a living treasury, which we're just beginning to tap.
And if we don't tap this treasury in the next decade, we're going to lose a huge part of it. And I think that's the urgency. Is the story simply going to be lost as each person leaves us? The amount of value in terms of the story is gone, is almost totally immeasurable. And so any of you, you know, if you record a little snippet like with something like this, that whole panel yesterday, and then what I did is I followed like a puppy dog behind those park people, and I was like poking them this in their ear and capturing all this other stuff. And it's very raw, but, you know, in 10 more years, these people may be completely unavailable to us, and the story will be lost forever, because it's very hard to piece together the whole personal carrier wave of this history from documents and artifacts. It's really hard to do that. It's virtually impossible, I think. So... Jeff has a question. Yeah, and in fact, I'm an engineer by training, and when I read I look at some of the so-called official histories, you just know in your heart of hearts that the thing has been totally candy coated and simplified for the media. And we saw this happening when BBC television was there. It was incredible. They were video, this presenter, you know, they only have a limited amount of time. They've got to present a story that's attractive to the audience. That's their goal. And this is BBC, who are pretty good. I mean, US media, forget it in a lot of cases. But BBC started, well, the presenter was up, and Alan, myself, and Daniel was the person being interviewed, but they were doing their rehearsal, and Daniel Cockey and Alan and myself were listening, and they were like saying, it's 1980, and Apple has just launched the Apple II, and Microsoft has just blah, 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 blah. And I walked over and said, excuse me, that's all completely wrong. What are you trying to do? Well, we're trying to compare and contrast what was happening at that time, because it's drama and it's exciting, but you're reading wrong history. That's not. And then Daniel came over and said, guys, the Apple II was launched at such and such. And then I said, look, Apple was going public. That was a big deal. It was raising a lot of money. And Microsoft was getting ready to, it was acquiring QDOS and was working with IBM sort of behind the scenes. That's the truth. And that, those were the two most, those were two powerful stories. And, well, that's not dramatic enough. You know, it doesn't show Bill Gates competing with Steve Jobs head on head like in a boxing ring. No, they're working in their own orbits. But, so the media is always trying to put spins on things. And so one of the things in, so that's what they do. Now Robert Cringely, I think, has done an excellent job overall. Well, he's at least gone out and interviewed the people, but that aside, one of the goals of the DigiBarn is to get engineers, salespeople, parents, kids, all the people from the ground up who really worked the long hours to build this thing up to tell the story, and their stories are fascinating. Their stories confound any of the simple explanations of anything. People move from company to company. They knew everybody. It wasn't a camp of Apple versus Microsoft or IBM versus. It wasn't such camps. It can't be simplified in that way. And it's the story of the ground up people that is being largely lost. I mean, the Park people, you'd think they'd be household names, and they're not. But even just somebody comes in and said, it's like when they were talking yesterday, 1974, I came and I saw this thing called the Alto, and I used it, and I, you know, the first, that's such a precious moment. A kid coming in at 12 years old, sitting down in front of an Alto, and doing the mouse thing, and learning how to run something on the Alto. That's like one of the first human beings, a young mind that's engaging in this system that's visual, and those are astounding moments that are lost. But as an adult, they give you this very crystal clear impression of what the Alto was. It was like a magic box. It was like that screen, the fact that you could see pixels on the screen. I remember one person describing to me as an electric etch-a-sketch. That was their impression of the thing. Because the etch-a-sketch was kind of, it was almost like a pixelated interface. And so it's these things that we're trying to grab before they're gone. The things that really put the meat into the story.
But perhaps not traditionally dramatic. The history and evolution of the stories of the toolmakers themselves are every bit as important as the CEOs. And that's something that the story hasn't really been told yet.
And so with that, are there some more questions? Because I know we're getting on here in time. From this illustrious audience. You are the converted, after all. I mean, certainly there are people who tell me I'm completely nuts, as they should. So I guess, one more question here.
The Cray is not running, right? That's the only machine you have that's not running as JDOS.
Yeah, the Cray, the cables were cut. It was from Lawrence Livermore Lab.
Yeah,
it's came... It's, well, someone offered me, I have a power distribution cabinet, and someone offered me, can you believe this, the diesel generator set for the Cray, which weighs tons. And so, I mean, it's the ultimate Cray collector in the world is Jim Curry, who has a barn with about 15 of these things in it. And he just had to move. Can you imagine that? He had to move. He moved from near Chippewa Falls to Indiana. And can you... He's a UPS freight pilot by day, and so he flies these giant freighters, but then he gets a week on, a week off. So in the week off, he built a pole barn, and he started collecting Cray supercomputers and C90s, and you name it, he's got it. And then they had to move to Indiana.
He said something like the cost for running the Cray one was $30,000 a month in electricity bills.
That was before
the And sitting on the bench seat of the Cray is a Pentium 300 motherboard, which I've been told is equivalent in terms of matrix processing ability, at which is worth about $30, I think, or $20 today. But, come visit us. If you can't visit today on this convoy we're going to do, just go to the site, fill in a form, say, I want to visit, and we'll get you in the next round if you want to contribute words, stories, artifacts, whatever, just send me and I'll get to the huge stack of forms at the end of the month. If you want to help...
Artifacts here, you know, take a look at them if you feel like it.
If you want to help technologically with the website and putting the infrastructure under it, it would be much appreciated. Thank you.